call the boogeyman. You have to let the record drop. The oil down the desert way has been shaken to the top. The shaky drove his Cadillac. He went a cruising down the beach. The muezzin was his standing on the radio.
Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Juan Cole talking about the Middle East. Juan Cole has testified before the U.S. Senate and knows Arabic and Persian. He blogs at Informed Comment and is a historian of South Asia. He's been a guest on PBS NewsHour, ABC Nightly News, Nightline, The Today Show, Charlie Rose, Anderson Cooper 360, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, The Colbert Report, Democracy Now!, and many others. He's lived in various parts of the Muslim world for nearly 10 years. The conversation between Juan Cole and Peter B. Collins centered on recent foreign policy developments, including Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Syria, Iran, Israel, Palestine, CIA, and drones.
Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan returns to our program today. He is the proprietor of a great blog called Informed Comment that you can find on the web just by entering his name, juancole.com, C-O-L-E. Professor, good to have you back with us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Peter.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, and we'll get to Justin Bieber at some point, I guess. I found an entry on your blog about him, and you never fail to surprise me with your breadth.
Well, thank you.
But first, we need to settle up because I met you in Ann Arbor last February and recorded an interview where you predicted that President Obama would, in fact, hold to his campaign promise and pull American troops out of Iraq by the end of this year. I was highly skeptical, and if I recall correctly, I placed a $5 bet with you. And so I am prepared, first of all, to say you were right. And I'm prepared to forward you an Abraham Lincoln piece of American currency to settle that up.
Well, I'll enjoy having a pizza on you, Peter. But I'm much happier that this long national nightmare in Iraq really is going to, I think, be at an end.
Well, and I will take it, and I do take it, and I appreciate the work of many people who went to the streets starting in 2002 to express their opposition to this misadventure, and I do think that we can take some solace that it was American protest and ultimately the move into the political arena that made a difference. But it's still a little unsatisfying because of the way President Obama, up until the very end, wanted to break that promise and keep at least thousands of troops, somewhere between 5,000 and 15,000 or 20,000, in Iraq for the foreseeable future. And as Peter Van Buren, the outspoken State Department fellow who has a new book out called We Meant Well, he said that decision was made in Baghdad. And while the president has put a spin on it that this is keeping his campaign promise, he did so quite reluctantly, wouldn't you say, Professor?
Well, there's been a lot of bad faith in the U.S. government about this issue of U.S. troops in Iraq from the beginning, because it was George W. Bush who negotiated the deal with the Iraqi parliament that led to the Status of Forces Agreement, mm-hmm. which specified that all U.S. troops, and it says all U.S. troops, should be out of Iraq by December 31st, 2011. And that was the price, that agreement was the price of U.S. troops not having to leave on December 31st, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the U.S. military presence in Iraq was authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and that was the legal framework under which the U.S. was engaging in combat in Iraq, arresting people, shooting people, and so forth. And the Iraqis declined to go back to the UN for a further resolution in 2008. So the Bush administration was facing a prospect that the U.S. would have thousands of troops fighting in Iraq with no legal cover. And that's just unacceptable to the U.S. military. You could end up with people being tried. There are courts in Europe and elsewhere that claim universal jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
The Iraqis made it clear that they would provide a legal framework, a bilateral legal framework between Iraq and the United States for U.S. troops to remain in Iraq in 2009 and 2010 and 2011, but that would be it. And so Bush took that deal, because otherwise he would have been faced with an ignominious rush for the exit at the very end of his presidency. And given that the economy had collapsed and that things hadn't already gone well in Iraq, I think he was afraid that that would permanently put him at the bottom of the list of great presidents. And so he took the deal. But I think everybody in the Bush administration thought that the Iraqis weren't serious about this, and that, well, you could always tinker with it later. Or maybe they wouldn't be so strict about enforcement. And that way of thinking infected the Obama administration as well. It was president in the Pentagon. And, you know, President Obama really has been unwilling to take on the Pentagon. He's done pretty much whatever they told him to do. So if they said they wanted to keep a division, which is about 25,000 troops in Iraq, then he would say, okay, well, we'll try and make that happen. But the likelihood of the U.S. being able to convince the Iraqi parliament to pass a law asking U.S. troops to come back into their country after they had left was always zero. And that was what I told you last February.
Well, and Muqtada al-Sadr would have either, you know, put the Maliki government into a hammerlock or caused a kind of breakdown. We know it took almost a year to seat the government after the most recent elections. And so Maliki has such a tenuous hold on power there that the idea that he would ask the U.S. for this concession would basically lead to his own political demise.
That's absolutely right. Iraq was faced with what is called a hung parliament. In a parliamentary system, you make your coalitions to get a majority after the election. It's the opposite of the U.S. We have these two parties which make their coalitions before the election. But in Iraq, as in Britain or France or Israel, the coalition is made after the election, so you've got all these parties, and they have to come up with 51% of the seats to elect a prime minister. And nobody could do that. It was this round robin. There were four major blocs, and they all hated each other, and none of them was willing to sit with the other in coalition. And it just went round and round. It was interminable. Luckily for the Iraqis, the Belgians hate each other even more, and so they were without a government for longer than Iraq was last year. So the Iraqis didn't even have the record on this. But nevertheless, what happened was that in the end, the Iranians, who were very concerned that there be a Shiite-dominated government in Iraq and not a minority government, say, of Sunnis and Kurds, they put pressure on Muqtada Sadr, the fiery young Ayatollah, to join al-Maliki, whom he hated, because al-Maliki's military forces had fought Sadr's Mahdi army in 2008 and defeated them in Basra. But nevertheless, Iran has some hold on Muqtada, who lives often in Iran now, and they twisted his arm, and he accepted to join the al-Maliki government. And so al-Maliki became prime minister for another term, but only because he got the 40 seats of the Sadr movement. And the Sadrists are the most vocal of Iraqis about the absolute intolerability of foreign troops in their country. So if al-Maliki had tried to keep the U.S. troops in Iraq, his government would have fallen. You wouldn't have had a prime minister. There could have been a vote of no confidence. So that's one. But the other thing is that al-Maliki all along, I mean, in December of 2010, he gave an interview with the Wall Street Journal. And he said that, you know, the Status of Forces Agreement couldn't be renegotiated. It was the law. It would be adhered to. He made it very clear that only, you know, another act of parliament, essentially another SOFA, or Status of Forces Agreement, would change the situation, and that he didn't expect it to occur. And the Pentagon just was tone deaf. They couldn't hear what al-Maliki was very openly saying, which was, you know, get used to it, guys, you're going.
Professor, the day after the president made his announcement and he spared us the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished and the padded crotch, you wrote on your blog, "The Iraq war is over except for the packing," President Obama announced on Friday. He held out hope that the U.S. would be at peace for the first time since 2001 in the coming years. The Libya war is ending and U.S. troops will steadily come out of Afghanistan through 2014. Alas, the peace will be illusory. It is not clear that we have learned the lessons of the Iraq fiasco, including, as I told Dan Frumkin, how to avoid being stampeded to war by unscrupulous politicians. The U.S. is entering an age of perpetual drone wars. The U.S. is hitting targets in Yemen and the tribal belt in Pakistan. When will the drone wars be over? The huge bloated military budget, higher than in the Cold War, keeps us forever on a war footing. The U.S. is also arming Israel to the teeth and stoking an arms race in the Middle East, even as Washington seeks de facto to deny Palestinians their right to a state and the basic human rights only a state can back. That is, the U.S. is deeply involved in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a partisan. 9/11 was in part a skirmish in that war. One more paragraph. U.S. sanctions on Iran are becoming so severe as to constitute a blockade, which in international law, which is an act of war. The war party in the U.S. is salivating for that war with Tehran, which has halfway begun as we speak. And it is freely acknowledged as a goal by most Republican presidential candidates. Now, I think there we went from the hopeful message of the president that he is winding down wars to an acceptance of the reality that this president has expanded our global military footprint, in particular into Yemen, into Somalia, now with a small number of troops headed for Uganda and trying to take out the Lord's Resistance Army. And I would argue that Obama is more of a war president than George W. Bush was.
Well, Peter, I wouldn't go that far. But it's certainly troubling that Obama has a fascination with extra-legal methods of covert warfare, including drone strikes. And he actually campaigned quite openly on drone strikes in 2007 and 2008, said we should be hitting Pakistan with drones, at a time when Bush wasn't doing it. So I can't compare Obama to Bush for war-making, just in the sense that, in my view, the Iraq war was illegal. It had no semblance of legality in international law. Bush pursued it as a war of choice, a war of aggression. and in the face of opposition from the UN Security Council. And I don't believe the congressional authorization to deal with the powers behind 9/11 authorized an Iraq war, because Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, however much they hinted around that it did.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So, I just can't accuse Obama of breaking international law to that extent.
But what basis do we have for our military actions in Yemen?
Yeah.
That's not too different from Bush.
I'm very critical of this kind of thing, right? But you asked me a question of what basis we have for it.
Right.
And there is an international legal basis for it, at least that can be argued, and which is argued by the U.S., which is that it's self-defense. And any country can always defend itself from people trying to harm it. And the 300 or so operatives of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, ACAP, which, have hit at U.S. and Saudi targets, and which openly, are conspiring to blow up things inside the United States.
That is alleged.
Have announced an intention to attack. So,
yes.
What Obama and his lawyers would say is that those people are attacking us. We have a right to defend ourselves.
Well, but it's preemption in most respects, because in particular, Anwar al-Awlaki has been accused, but they've offered no proof that he took military action against the United States. He appears to have counseled and inspired people who attempted to commit terrorist acts, but we haven't established any proof of any of that. And I find that very troubling, the whole process by which we use drones to take out an American citizen in a third country has really produced only a ripple of negative reaction in this country. And I think it's a very dangerous precedent and well outside the law.
Oh, well, I'm with you. I think one of the problems is the law. We need new laws. That is to say, we need new procedures, new laws to deal with this kind of a thing. The law as it currently exists is inadequate to the task. What the Obama administration maintains is that, remember, there was that plot to send bombs to a synagogue in Chicago.
Right, the ink cartridges.
Yeah, the inkjet printers.
Uh-huh.
The Obama administration maintains that it now has evidence that al-Awlaki was actively involved in that plot. That he's not just somebody who makes YouTube videos and rants. That he's had a hand in operational activities.
Well, now that he's dead, can't we see that evidence?
Well, I agree with you. It's very troubling that the Department of Justice and the FBI and the CIA should be judge, jury, and executioner. And it's not right. Moreover, I mean, there are bigger issues. The drone program is very often run by the CIA,
mm-hmm.
Which is a civilian agency in the executive. The U.S. Constitution assumes that war making should be under the Department of Defense. Should be a military activity. So we have civilians, and apparently, so often the CIA contracts out the drone strikes to companies. So we're back to the 18th century when the East India Company was running India. I mean, you have private security firms firing drones at people, and apparently they could be American citizens. It is. If you think about it, dystopian. It's like Blade Runner. I mean, it's a dystopian kind of nightmare that actually exists now as we live, and we're not even, I think, always aware of it. But because it's run by the CIA, the program is covert, and so nobody can talk about it. It's classified. So if I were at a news conference as a blogger / journalist, and I asked Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about a drone strike, she could neither affirm nor deny that such a thing had even taken place. She couldn't talk about the program as classified. Well, that's not democratic. We've got a program that's going on that is, an executive program. It's not open to scrutiny. What its defenders would say is that everything is shared with members of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee and the House counterpart. I guess there are maybe 15 or 20 elected representatives who are at least being informed of what's being done. At least that's what we're being told. But that's not enough for me. You know, this is not a democratic setup.
Well, I agree. And in the case of Al Awlaki and his two teenage sons, the sons appear to have been collateral damage, incidental to other targets. But Al Awlaki himself was targeted, was put on a list of killer capture. We are not told who the members are of the subcommittee of the National Security Council who place people on that list. Then it's really murky exactly how the president approves or just declines to reject a recommendation like that. And then it is clandestinely carried out. And all of this offers us no checks, no balances, no transparency. It's a trust me approach. And I guess most people trust President Obama. But if it were President Perry or, you know, name your favorite Republican of the week, I'm very uncomfortable giving that power to any president, including the sitting one.
Well, I'm with you, and of course there are conservatives who don't trust Obama and who are saying that, you know, as things now stand, if Obama wanted to send a drone strike on St. Louis and kill one of his political enemies, that there would be nothing anybody could do about it. And beyond that, you know, if we send troops into a foreign country, we have to have a status of forces agreement with it, or a UN resolution. Why wouldn't the same thing be true of drone strikes? I think I do worry about our national security. I don't deny that there are some people who are conspiring to kill my kid. I would like to see that stopped. But if it were necessary, in fact, that this is the only way that such an attack could be stopped, and it involved a drone strike in a foreign country, I would want that to be voted on by Congress. I would want there to be congressional oversight. I would want it not to be covert. I would want it to be in the Department of Defense. And then I would want an agreement with the country that permits such a thing. We have a tacit agreement with Pakistan. Their politicians come out and denounce the drone strikes, but we know from the WikiLeaks cables that they authorized them behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that should be explicit. I fear that we're losing a framework of international law, of legality for the actions of the U.S. government. And as you say, when it gets to the point where a U.S. citizen can be essentially assassinated on secret charges, I think that any of the founding fathers involved in writing the Constitution would find that absolutely unacceptable, because this is exactly the kind of thing with star chambers and bills of attainder and so forth that the British monarchy used to do in the 18th century. Our country was founded to make such abuses of the executive difficult.
A little song I wrote, you might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry. Be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry.
Be happy.
Look at me, I'm happy. Don't worry. Be happy. I give you my phone number. When you worry, call me. I make you happy.
Don't worry. Be happy. Ain't got no cash, ain't got no style, ain't got no gal to make you smile. But don't worry. Be happy. Cause when you worry, your face will frown, and that will bring everybody down. So don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry. Be happy now. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, don't worry, don't do it. Be happy. Put a smile on your face. Don't bring everybody down like this. Don't worry.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And now for something completely different.